want to welcome you to Carl Maloney's COVID cast. I'm Matthew Berkowitz, and with me are Sam Lewis and Brian O'Shea. And we've been looking over the last couple of podcasts and at issues facing the courts and a number of different defendants and businesses in light of COVID and in the context of class actions. And this week, we're going to be looking and discussing some of the types of class actions that are being filed against universities in light of COVID. And at this point, I'm going to just turn it over to Brian, who's going to just give a brief overview of some of those claims.
Well, I think the major type of claim that we're seeing right now are claims being brought by classes of students, typically attending the same college, who are basically claiming that they're not getting what they're paying for as a result of the social distancing measures and the online education measures that these colleges and universities have been putting in place to comply with the state social distancing guidelines.
And by that, Brian, you're talking about what they're paying? Just to clarify, what they're paying for, you're saying basically they're, from what I've seen, is that there are students that are upset and the suits involved, that they are not getting what they paid for in terms of the education, that they're paying for an in-person education and it's been moved to an online platform. Is that what you're seeing as well?
Yes, but I think that's part of it. I think also they're claiming that they're paying for an experience, a college experience that we were all lucky enough to have. And that experience, that on-campus experience, is part of what they're paying for. And as a result of the social distancing measures that have been put in place, they're not getting that part of the college experience either. And they're claiming that their tuition and fees are essentially being overcharged as a result.
Right. So we're getting obviously a lot of breach of contract type claims. And now,
exactly.
Obviously, there are a number of defenses to that. I'm going to flip it over to Sam just to kick us off on some of the defenses that universities are raising or those that we may see colleges and universities to start raising. So, Sam?
Sure. So, as Matt mentioned, the primary cause of action in the majority of these cases is breach of contract, unjust enrichment, and we've seen some plaintiffs' counsel also assert the cause of action of conversion on the grounds that the online education does not reflect what they actually paid for in the form of tuition. The question here is whether there was an existence of a contract. And if there was a contract, did it have a controlling arbitration provision? Is there any mention of force majeure? The doctrine of impossibility, you know, a lot of these states issued stay-at-home orders. How could the universities possibly operate it under those conditions? And a lot of times, courts around the country have found education malpractice not to be a viable cause of action due to public policy reasons. And these cases are being perceived as breach of contract claims that are veiled as actually being education malpractice. So there are many defenses available, and it's definitely fact dependent.
I'm going to flip this question back over to Brian, because obviously this was to a large degree arguably an unforeseeable event or something of this nature. And while there may not be contract with specific language, but are we seeing also that interpretation or trying to apply implied contracts, that there was an understanding, a meeting of the minds through the conduct, that there's an expectation of this in-person experience, even though it may not guarantee I'm paying X amount of dollars for in-person classes? I don't know, Brian, you want to take that or Sam?
So,
or neither.
Well, to the extent I understand,
it may not necessarily be written out in a contract, but a lot of these plaintiffs are relying on the marketing materials that the schools provide, illustrating the experience aside from the actual learning aspect of university life. And it's a question of whether that marketing material factors into an expectation versus, you know, getting the bread and butter learning experience.
Gotcha. All right. And then one of the things you raised was force majeure, and this is really what I wanted Brian to address, is just the force majeure clauses and how that may operate, and is that even likely to be seen in the applications, the materials, or contracts, or payment receipts, or anything of that nature that universities and colleges could basically point to?
Well, yeah, I think force majeure clauses are a major issue here, and I don't think it's clear, at least in all cases, whether they're going to stand up. I know some, I'm not sure how far this has gotten in court yet, but I know there's been some doubt expressed in attorney circles about whether this actually was an unforeseeable event or not. I mean, we all know that people have been predicting and opining on pandemics like this for years, and schools have plans in place to address them. But and not all schools even have force majeure clauses in place. I know I was doing some poking around of my alma mater's policies, and they actually do have a force majeure clause in place requiring that, when you register for classes, that locks you in to paying tuition for that next semester. And even if the school is shut down or is otherwise restricted in operations for any reason, you're required to pay that that tuition, even if all of your classes are online. Now, personally, I think that that force majeure clause there looks pretty tight. And I think it might be difficult to overcome that, but every school is different, and not every school has that type of policy in place.
Yeah, and I just want to chime in. I'm just thinking as we're talking, you know, there have been instances, and this is just more food for thought, and then we've got to move on to the class issues. But, you know, there have been instances where when I was in school and others that, you know, there's Snowmageddon in D.C., and a few years back, and when I was in school, class was shut down for 2 weeks. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I didn't get every single day in classroom teaching that I maybe thought I was going to get. So obviously this is a little bit longer and it moved to a different platform, but certainly there's not always been this, I guess, one-for-one expectation of getting it. And I think that kind of moves into the class issues that I think we were discussing previously, and I think we all agree that these types of suits, I think, are going to be face a number of challenges to the plaintiff's side to get a class certified. I mean, the one that just jumps out at me is basically another defense, but that of being reliance, which is going to potentially destroy commonality and the predominancy element that people, we've talked about it, different expectations. People rely on the marketing materials differently, have different expectations of their experience. Some certainly went to college to get that college experience to be with other students in the classroom. Other people just go to college and pay the big bucks just to get a piece of paper. So I think you're going to have the reliance is people are not necessarily relying, not everybody's relying on, assuming there's a promise or the expectation, they're not relying on it the same way. And I think that's going to create problems in plaintiffs establishing that there are common issues, as well as require individual inquiries into each and every student's levels of reliance and expectations, which is would destroy predominance. So that's the one thing that jumps out at me. That's certainly one of, if not the strongest defense to defending against class certification. Sam or Brian, what else are you guys seeing?
You definitely see the fact that all of the students are enrolled in different majors. You have, say, you have an English major where theoretically most of the work can be done online and independently, but then you have another student that's a biology student, which has who has required time in labs and in-person activities that they were not able to complete because of the epidemic. So that's
right. So their the actual education that they're getting might be different or less than what they're quote unquote paying for, I guess, is
right.
Which goes to the same point, Brian.
And I would also add, you know, how do you put a value on any of that? I mean, if you're a lab student and you're not able to go to lab, are you entitled to greater damages than an English major who is presumably not going to labs as often? I think that might be an important question to consider in terms of the individual inquiries that are required. And I think also, just quickly, a court on damages will have to possibly perform an individual analysis of each student's financial situation, whether the student is receiving financial aid and how much financial aid that student is receiving, grants, scholarships as well. Do all of those, I would presume, would factor into an individual damages calculation as well, because every student is making it, even at the same school, are making different levels of personal investment to attend that school.
Also,
and that's a good point.
A number of students received grants under the CARES Act, the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act.
Well, but I want to go just strictly to damages. And I guess maybe this is not necessarily speculative, but somehow indeterminable, how, assuming a court was willing to maybe bifurcate and allow individual inquiries on damages, how do you measure damages in this case, I'd submit? You are still getting the education. Is it the fact that you had to take it online from a good university, is that going to be disqualifying you from a job in the future? And how do you prove that you're going to be disqualified from a job? Have you actually suffered any tangible harm? I mean, maybe there's some emotional experience and a few dollars here and there, but at the end of the day, what damages, at least hard numbers, are suffered? And then how do you measure that? What's the value that's lost? So that was something that I was just thinking about. That was a good point that Brian raised. We are running out of time, but before we sign off, just any final thoughts from Sam or Brian?
Yeah, I think out of the topics that we've discussed so far in terms of the potential impact on a single industry, the class action lawsuits that we're seeing, I think could have a really significant impact, especially on smaller private colleges, and every college relies on tuition, but those colleges especially rely on tuition, hence why they charge so much. And so there's going to be a lot of pressure on colleges and universities of all sizes to open as much as they can, which is kind of what we're seeing right now, and also to vigorously defend these claims because it could turn into a slippery slope that could really affect their ability to collect full tuition for similar potential crises in the future.
Okay. Thanks,
and
Brian.
And Sam, to follow up on that, I think that we might see a trickle down to boarding schools and lower level educational institutions, which also may have an effect on the overall industry from a financial perspective.
All right. Well, thanks, guys. We are out of time, and we thank you for listening to us today, and we look forward to bringing you our next topic in the coming days. Thank you, and have a great day.